I'm going to be talking about some particular examples of quantum information processing. And in particular, what I'm going to talk about is, can we think very hard about them and get some idea of what's truly quantum mechanical about them? But to motivate that, perhaps we should think about why we're interested in quantum information processing. And here's one reason. It's not the only reason, but it's a pretty good reason. And this is the famous Moore's Law, which usually has something to do with the size of processing elements or the speed of processing elements. Here it's the number of components on a chip. And that's been rising exponentially for the last 30 years or so. And that blue line you see there is what's been achieved, and the green line is the semiconductor industry's roadmap. And if they continue on the path they want, that is with Moore's Law, in about 2010 they'll be down to about 8 electrons per gate, and quantum mechanics is going to be important. So one way or another, if present classical computers continue on the road they're on, we're going to have to start thinking about quantum mechanics. And we can either regard quantum... it's going to be important. No question, it's going to be important. And the question is whether it's going to be a friend or a foe. And I think the lesson of quantum information processing is that quantum mechanics can be a friend. You can do things with quantum information processing that can't be done if the world were classical. There's another, actually, Moore's second law, which is equally threatening, and that's the cost of a fab plant, which has also been rising exponentially. And about 2010, it's going to cost about $50 billion to build a fab plant. I hope they're in Albuquerque, like some of them are now, because even a small amount, that falling off to the side, and you can do pretty well. But something's got to give here, because at some point we're going to be spending the whole GMP. Sorry? This, of course, is a linear plot. So, it's exponential. Sorry. Yeah, that's probably quite true. Still, it's very threatening because it suggests that at some point it's going to cost a trillion dollars to build a fab plant, and something different is going to have to be done. I don't know if we all need, we'll need personal computers that are so fast when we're spending the entire GMP to make the chips. What that emphasizes is that we have to worry about how information is represented. If we're going to get serious about quantum information processing, we have to worry about how information is represented in our machines. And the lesson here is that information is physical. Information processing depends on physical law. Now, that's a terrific thing for physicists, and most of us here are physicists. It puts us right at the center of the information age and eventually at the center of the information economy. That'll be a good place to be. And what we're going to be able to do is spend now quite a long time investigating the possibilities of quantum information processing. Of course, as we've gotten into quantum information processing, it's gotten more and more complicated. And I would say now, less than 5 years ago, we know less. Well, we don't know less, but we understand less about what really makes quantum information processing powerful. In particular, there's a lot of controversy about what makes a quantum computer powerful. And for me, this always arises when I go to lunch at my favorite New Mexican restaurant in New Mexico, just south of the UNM campus. It's El Patio. This is an artist's rendition. Well, not a very good artist's rendition, but an artist's rendition of us standing in front of El Patio, and we're wondering, what does a quantum computer... This is me. I did not such a bad job on me. Aside from the stick figure. Is it superposition? Is it quantum parallelism? This is Ivan Deutsch. I'm glad Ivan's not here. Is it non-factorizable unitaries? Is it entanglement? And you can see some people in the restaurant aren't worried about the question of what makes a quantum computer powerful. They're ordering their lunch and being asked the New Mexico State question, red or green. And if you don't understand that, ask me about it afterward. So I think it's important that we, when we are interested in quantum information processing, that we think very carefully about what is really quantum mechanical about various protocols for quantum information processing. I'm going to consider two today. One is information processing using NMR, and the other is the teleportation of coherent states, which was done at Caltech several years ago. This is not meant to be a negative exercise. The point is that if we find methods for doing information processing that are between classical and quantum, then this is what we need to understand to find out what's truly distinctive about both classical information processing and quantum information processing. So the first example I'm going to be looking at is NMR. And in doing this, I like to keep in mind a certain rule. Now, since, as you all know, I've done many things in physics and nothing is named after me, I've decided to name this after myself. That is, this is the preemptive strike. And nobody's going to disagree. Caves' rule is, if you can explain it, it's not quantum. And of course, the equivalent statement is, if it's quantum, you can't explain it. Of course, what explain here means explain in the language, the realistic language of our ordinary experience. When I give popular talks about quantum mechanics, I like to start off by saying that we proved mathematically that you can't understand what I'm going to talk about, so don't blame me. And that's more or less true, that we know you can't understand entanglement in quantum mechanics using the language of ordinary experience. So keep that little rule in mind. It'll especially come up toward the end of the talk, and I'll try to keep it here because I need that. And now let's get on to NMR. And the question we want to ask is, in NMR quantum computing, where's the quantum? So to get into this, I think we need first to set the stage by just describing how an NMR sample can be used for information processing. And this is actually one of the great surprises, that you can do anything with NMR. It's a high-temperature environment. Actually, it was at the last ITP program, just at the beginning of it, the last ITP program on quantum information, that the ideas for information processing using NMR actually arose, and many of them were developed here, and then were actually done in experiments. Compared to other methods for implementing quantum information processing, NMR is far ahead. And so it really does pay us to think hard about exactly what's going on in an NMR experiment. So what are the processing elements in NMR? The qubits are nuclear spins. I've drawn some simple molecules that were used in some of the early experiments here. The most ambitious experiments are now up to something like 7 nuclear spins and controlling the states of 7 nuclear spins. And you might get to 10 or 12 nuclear spins in liquid samples. There are more ambitious efforts to do NMR information processing in solid-state NMR. I won't be talking about those. I'm only going to be talking about liquid-state NMR at high temperature. So in the first example there, some of the early experiments were done in chloroform, and the processing elements were the carbon-13 nucleus and the proton. And then 3-qubit experiments were done with trichloroethylene. So you have a bunch of these molecules in a liquid sample, a macroscopic number of them, and they're in a test tube, and you stick the test tube down in a big magnet. The big magnet is B0. The fields are roughly, well, they're as big as you can get, 10 Tesla or so. And then there's an RF field, much weaker RF field in the transverse plane that oscillates at a frequency omega, and that can drive transitions between the levels that are split by the big magnetic field. So what can we say about this? Because this is a liquid sample, the spins in different molecules don't interact because of the tumbling in the liquid state. That is, the magnetic dipole interaction between the spins is averaged away to zero. Moreover, within each molecule, the magnetic dipole interaction is averaged away to zero, and all that's left is the contact interaction between nuclei mediated by the valence electrons. Of course, the advantage of using NMR is it's a very highly developed technology. It's been around for over 50 years. It's mainly not a subject in physics anymore. It's a subject in chemistry and biology. That means that it's a very highly developed field, and you can use a lot of techniques that are just sitting there ready to be used. So why might you think you can do anything in NMR? Well, the reason is the nuclear spins are sitting in little cages, and they're effectively isolated from the environment. The thermal relaxation times can be 1,000 seconds or longer, and the phase damping or decoherence times can be 1/10 of a second to 10 seconds. Of course, so that phase damping time is important, but you have to compare that to the time it takes to do gates, and we'll see how long it takes to do that on the next slide. So here we draw another artist rendition, in this case of a two-spin molecule in an NMR sample. So there's my two spins, A and B, big magnetic field, the RF field. The big magnetic field splits the magnetic sublevels of the spins by some frequency omega. And for the big magnetic fields that are used, that's between about 1 and 6 times 10 to the 8 hertz. In fact, the way you buy an NMR spectrometer is you buy it in megahertzes, and that's the resonant frequency of a proton placed in the magnetic field that spectrometer can produce. And so a 600 megahertz spectrometer is pretty good. So that's the grossest effect going on in such a system. In fact, every spin is in its own chemical environment, and that produces other shifts called chemical shifts, which are smaller, much smaller, on the order of 100 to 10,000 hertz. So effectively, every spin, even if the spins are this, or it, well, if the spins are different, like hydrogen and carbon-13, they're going to have different resonant frequencies. But even if they're the same, they'll have different frequencies in the molecule because these chemical shifts will be different. And that allows you, by so-called soft pulses, to address all the spins individually, provided there aren't too many of them, so that the lines get all confused. So these two things are important. And then the coupling between spins, which is on all the time, is called J. And that's the coupling, as I said, mediated by the valence electrons. And that's quite weak. It's typically a tenth of a hertz to 100 hertz. So let's say it's 100 hertz and our decoherence time is 10 seconds. You can get in 1,000 operations before you run out of gas. So that's the reason why NMR looks good. There's this highly developed technology for controlling the states of the nuclear spins. You can get the nuclear spins to interact. And the problem is they interact all the time. You can't turn off that coupling. But people working in NMR have devised very clever techniques for effectively turning off the coupling, effectively by using spin echo. So I'm not going to say any more about the details of NMR experiments, but now I'm just going to abstract away to what you do in so-called bulk ensemble quantum computation. That is what you do when you have this kind of sample of many molecules. Each molecule is then like a little computer. The processing elements in each molecule are the various nuclear spins, and you have a macroscopic number of them. So the properties of bulk ensemble quantum computation are you have a high-temperature thermal ensemble, you have no control of the individual constituents, that is, you can do parallel operations on all the molecules. You can pick out a particular spin in a particular molecule, but then you'll apply the same operation, the same transformation to every spin of that sort in the sample. That's not quite true, but for our purposes, it's good enough. You can do a little better, but you don't. The point is, you can't go in and make one particular spin in one particular molecule do something and nothing else does anything. And finally, you can't read out the state of individual molecule. What you can do is you can pick up the magnetic field produced by the spins as they process about the big magnetic field, and that tells you basically a set of expectation values that we'll say something about in a minute. So how do you do anything? The first problem you got to deal with is that the sample's in thermal equilibrium. And so the first thing you do is you prepare what's called a pseudo-pure state. And that means a mixture of the maximally mixed state. So M I use to stand for the state where all the spins are randomly up and down. And that's mixed with another state, rho 1, which typically you'd want to be a pure state. So this is the density operator for each molecule in the sample. All of them have the same density operator, at least to zero order. And every one of those is a mixture of the maximally mixed state and some other state. What Probably the most important thing that people realized when this was proposed was how to synthesize pseudo-pure states, because in thermal equilibrium, this rho 1 is initially just the state you get when you expand the density operator, the thermal equilibrium density operator for high temperature, and it's certainly not a pure state, but you can, by a series of basically decoherence operations, prepare, make rho 1 a pure state. That is, you can make it a state where, let's say, all the spins are down. And the price you pay for doing that is that this quantity epsilon, which tells you what fraction of the sample is actually in that state, scales in the following way. It looks like a quantity alpha. Alpha is basically tells you how much the sample is polarized, and that's about 2 times 10 to the minus 5 for the magnetic fields they have. So alpha characterizes how much the sample is polarized initially in thermal equilibrium, and then when you synthesize a pseudo-pure state, epsilon goes as alpha times n divided by 2 to the n. And that n over 2 to the n is there for a reason. That basically tells you the initial population of the all-down state or the all-up state. And that's the reason that appears. So you use that state to prepare your pseudo-pure state. You wipe out all the other states, and so that's the biggest you can make, epsilon. So you can immediately see you've got a problem, because epsilon decreases exponentially in the number of qubits n, the number of nuclear spins. All right, so then you perform quantum gates. That's what NMR does exquisitely well. You can perform any unitary you want using the RF field and the J coupling. And the nice thing is that when you apply a unitary operation to rho, it doesn't have any effect on this maximally mixed state. It doesn't change it. So you end up with a state of exactly the same form. Should have an epsilon there, and that's managed to escape God knows how many talks now before I even noticed it. But anyway, you wind up with a state of exactly the same form, and all that's happened is that your pseudo-pure, the pure part of your pseudo-pure state has changed under the unitary in just the way you'd like. Yeah?
When you start with your initial ensemble, why is it that you can't come up with some physical process for encouraging the state you want for a one?
There are ways to polarize the sample more, although they haven't been used successfully in these kinds of experiments, and they're hard to do. That, however, would just make the initial alpha bigger, and then you'd need to synthesize a pseudo-pure state in the same way. So there are ways to make things better. I'm not going to worry about those. This is the best you can do, given the fact that the state that's most highly populated is the ground state, with all the spins aligned with the magnetic field, and that n over 2 to the n, that's what that's about. All right, so you prepare the pseudo-pure state, you perform your quantum gates, and then at the end you want to do some readout. And what you can do, as I said before, is to read out the magnetization of the sample. And if you think hard about that, that means you can measure all of these expectation values. The expectation value of any product of Pauli operators and the unit operator. So that actually, you can easily see, that would allow you to characterize the density operator entirely if you read out all of those. So you can do that. You can easily do quantum state tomography and find the state, find what state you've got. So again, when we put this in here, the maximally mixed state doesn't produce any signal, doesn't produce any magnetization. So all that you see is the signal produced by this fraction epsilon of the molecules that are in the pseudo-pure state. And there's the signal-to-noise problem in NMR. As you increase the number of nuclear spins in your molecule, the signal goes down exponentially. And so eventually you would need a sample whose size increases exponentially in the number of qubits. And so that's the resource problem in NMR. And so it's known that this kind of pseudo-pure state information processing in NMR is not scalable. It's known. Practically, this probably sets a limit around 10 qubits unless you use some technique like optical pumping to increase the initial polarization. All right. So I've been using, because it's very easy to do, I've been saying that the fraction of molecules that are in the desired state is epsilon. And that's called the NMR preferred ensemble fallacy. And so I want to talk about that for a minute. It's true you can think about the NMR sample that way, as though a fraction epsilon of the molecules were in the desired pure state and the rest were just randomly distributed around the Black sphere. But it's not the only way to think about things, and that's where questions arise about what's happening in NMR information processing. So the questions we want to ask are the states classical, and is the dynamics classical? I'm going to claim the states are classical, that is, they're separable, and we can think of all the states in NMR experiments in terms of nuclear spins pointing in different directions, and we just don't know the direction. The harder question is, can we map the NMR state from one configuration to another, one classical configuration to another, when they actually implement entangling unitary operations? And I'll leave a question mark there. I will say something about it when we get to it. So let's just say a little bit more about the preferred ensemble fallacy. So here's the thing that you might want to do in an NMR experiment, and this was done very early on with 2-qubits. You start with the state mixture of maximally mixed plus both spins pointing up. And now you do a 90-degree rotation of the first spin about the y-axis, followed by a controlled knot, and that converts this up-up state to a maximally entangled state. It converts up-up to up-up plus down-down, and that's an EPR of Bell state. It's maximally entangled. So if you use the preferred ensemble fallacy, you would think, well, we produce some entanglement, and it's just that a small fraction of the molecules in the sample are entangled. However, we have to think a little harder. We have to ask, is there any classical ensemble that could explain this, that could be used to model this state? And what I'll mean by a classical ensemble is I just imagine I've got the two spins. They've got their spin, their block vectors, n sub a and n sub b. And the question is, can I describe this state just by a probability distribution for these two block vectors? And it turns out that as long as epsilon is less than or equal to a ninth, all states of this sort for 2-qubits have such a classical ensemble. So, and they aren't anywhere close to epsilon equal to a ninth. So what that means is that we can regard this kind of state as a mixture of states with the spins pointing in different directions, and we can describe all the measurements on it in terms of averages over that classical ensemble. Well, now that's a good question. Nothing funny happens. And so what's true is that you can easily prove, it's a trivial proof, that for everything epsilon less than or equal to a ninth, that is in a little ball about the maximally mixed state, everything is separable. What happens outside of epsilon equal to a ninth is harder to deal with. After a certain point, like epsilon equal to a third, you know there are entangled states. But between a ninth and a third, really very little is known about whether the states are separable or not. And so you have to look at every state and try to figure out whether it's separable. No. There's probably, I actually think that the separable state started epsilon equal a third, but we don't know. But at some point there, well, I mean, along some directions, you can go out to product states. So along some directions away from the maximally mixed state, you go all the way out to the edge of density operator space to a pure state, and it's still separable. So there's a very complicated geometry of stuff sticking in from the boundary toward epsilon equal a third or epsilon equal a ninth. Somewhere along there, entangled states start to arise. So all I'm saying is below epsilon equal to a ninth, there's no entanglement. Between a ninth and a third, everything is open. So just because you get above epsilon equal a ninth doesn't mean you've produced entanglement. Let's see. I think I'm going to just... I'm going to show you how to construct the classical ensemble. So let's do this for 2-qubits, and then we'll say a little bit about n-qubits. And let's take a particular example here. This will show you how the epsilon equal to a third gets into the picture. So up there at the top, I've written four maximally entangled states called the Bell states. And then I've written here a so-called Wernher state, which is a mixture of the maximally mixed state plus one of the maximally entangled states. So it's of the form that I'm talking about. It's a pseudo-pure state with the pure part being a maximally entangled state. This state is separable if and only if epsilon is less than or equal to a third. And let me just say what that means, because I haven't actually said what separability is. A state is separable if it has an ensemble decompositions in terms of product states. So any state that's separable can be written like this. You integrate over the two block spheres. These are projectors onto states on the block sphere. With a positive probability distribution, then the state's separable, and that's if and only if. A state's separable if and only if you can write it in this form. Now, the nice thing is for qubits, a separable decomposition is equivalent to an ensemble of classical tops. We've just got tops pointing in different directions. And all of these expectation values that we talked about can be written simply as expectation values of these spin directions over this probability distribution W. So you can interpret everything that happens in a separable state in terms of a classical model of tops pointing in different directions. Let me just give you a hint of why epsilon equal a third is the boundary there. It's not hard to show, it's probably not worth showing here. And so I'll just give you an ensemble that works for the Wernher state, and you can kind of see why epsilon equal a third is the boundary. So here's an ensemble that works for the Wernher state. We're going to have an ensemble consisting of six different possibilities. I didn't want to write this out in density operator notation. It's too annoying to do that. So it's a mixture of up, up, and down, down, x, x, and minus x, minus x, and y, minus y, and minus y, y. So if you're good at this, you go like this. And very quickly, you get confused, and so I don't do that. But anyway, the point is, in this particular Bell state, the z spins are correlated. The x spins are correlated, and the y spins are anticorrelated. And this tries to get that correlation into a mixture, but you can see what goes wrong. This gets the z correlations right, but of course, in this, if we just had these two things, then the x spins would be uncorrelated, and the y spins would be uncorrelated. So everything's reduced by a factor of 3, and so this only gets 1/3 of the pure state into the ensemble. The proof is essentially just turning this around. There's a lot of neat ensembles you can write down, but I'm not going to do that. Let's just show you what happens for n qubits.
When you say maximally entangled, there should be a quantity of measures entanglement. There should be a real number of measures entanglement. How do you find it?
Well, for these states, it's real easy, because these two qubit states, in fact, for any bipartite, that is two system pure states, it's just the marginal entropy of one system or the other. And so for this case, the marginal entropy is one bit, and so it's maximally entangled. That's the biggest it can be. You trace out one of the systems, and then the other one is left in a maximally mixed state. So for pure states, that's easy. You can see why that, well, this is a good example of why it doesn't work for mixed states, because the same thing would be true for the Wernher state. And so trace out one system and you got the maximally mixed state, even if epsilon's zero. So it's not a very good measure of entanglement for mixed states, but for pure states, it's a good measure.
The general definition
is that it's not separable. That is to say, the state can't be written for pure states. It's that the state can't be written as a product of pure states. And for mixed states, it can't be written as an ensemble of products of pure states. So we're dealing with separable states here, which can be written as an ensemble of product states.
Yeah, I just wondered to understand it doesn't depend on the choice of values, on the choice of separation of the whole base on the two parts.
Nope, doesn't depend on that at all. Everything, all the measures of entanglement are constructed to be explicitly independent of local unitaries that change the bases of the two systems. So nothing depends on the bases of the two systems.
Right.
All right, let's do the one piece of math that I'm going to do in this talk, which is just to show you where the bound for the entanglement of pseudo-pure states arises. So we've got one of these pseudo, well, this is any density operator for n qubits. And we're going to write it in this form, an integral over all the Black spheres for n systems, some quantity w, which then depends on all the spins, and then a bunch of projectors. That's a product state where the first spin is in the state n1, the next one's in n2, and so on. And because I don't want to be writing out all these diddly vectors all the time, we'll just use a twiddle to stand for all of them, and that's what the second thing means. So actually, any state can be written in this form, because the product operators are an overcomplete operator basis, so any state can be expanded like this. Moreover, they're terribly overcomplete, so the W quantity is not unique. It turns out that what rho determines is the following. If we expanded the W quantity in a product of spherical harmonics for all the different Black spheres, the density operator determines the L equals 0 and 1 components. That's real easy to see. And so the freedom in this W lies in the higher order spherical harmonics. And rho is separable if there exists one of these W's that's everywhere non-negative, because most states, that is all the entangled states, there's no way to find any W that's everywhere non-negative. So having said that the thing is terribly non-unique, and that sounds like a terrible mess. Well, in fact, what you do is you just use the simplest choice, which is the one that has only L equals 0 and L equals 1 components in it, and we'll just ask if that one's positive. So if that one's positive, the state is separable. Of course, if it's negative, it doesn't tell you the state's entangled. But we're interested. You see, our boundary is miles away from where they're operating in NMR, so we're not so interested in the other question. So anyway, this is a kind of canonical W, only has the L equals 0 and L equals 1 components. It's a quasi-distribution obtained by taking the trace of rho against a certain operator. Here's that operator. It's a product operator. The only thing you need to know about it is that every one of these terms has eigenvalues equal to 4 and minus 2. So the minimum value that this W can take on is the minimum value of Q. The minimum eigenvalue of Q, and you get that by letting all of them be 4 except 1, which is minus 2, and so that gives you this minimum value. Now, it's real easy to see if you tack on enough unit density operator, you can make it positive for anything. So it's just a matter of playing through that and seeing where it's guaranteed to be positive for all states that you stick in as rho 1, and you work that out, and it turns out that all states are separable. So you just use this minimum eigenvalue condition. If epsilon's less than or equal to a quantity called eta, which looks like this, it goes exponentially as 1 over 2 to the minus 2n. So here's the values of eta for a few spins. You can see even at 6, we're not close to a value of epsilon which they have in NMR experiments, where they're starting at 10 to the minus 5 and getting smaller as n increases. So yeah, so you will get there. You will cross this boundary because 8 is going as 2 to the minus 2n and their epsilon is going as 2 to the minus n. So what are the conclusions? All the n qubit states of this form, pseudo-pure states, are separable under these conditions. And all measurements can then be understood in terms of an ensemble of classical tops pointing in different directions. So for NMR, this means all NMR states are separable for n less than or equal to about 12 qubits, if alpha is what they have, which is about 2 times 10 to the minus 5. That means that no NMR experiment has created any entanglement to date, because the biggest experiments are up around 7 qubits. And all measurements in present NMR experiments can be understood in terms of classical correlations among the spins. And this is the International Nobel in NMR symbol. So let's just summarize that. Can present NMR experiments create entangled quantum states? The answer is no. Even if they got up to 12 qubits, they'd have to show us, because that's where our guarantee that they fail goes out of effect. But we don't provide any warrant of success once you get past 12 qubits. So all that seems pretty, you know, the real You mean the real boundary? No, no. You can show there's another boundary, which I'm not talking about, which is where they definitely can reach an entangled state, and they could reach that. But I've forgotten how many qubits that would require. Can't remember. I think it goes as 2 to the minus n over 2. Maybe Rüdiger remembers. No, he doesn't remember either. But they can get there. Yeah, so that must not be right. They can reach entangled states at a very large number of qubits, where it's guaranteed they could make one. But I've forgotten what the scaling is.
But isn't that an important question? Because otherwise, if you ask this for a quantum computer, you would like that. If you were arguing about this instrumentation, we would have been answered classically.
It is an important question. It maybe isn't quite so important because they're not going to get to those numbers of spins before they do something completely different. The future of NMR is in solid-state NMR, where they actually optically pump and produce highly polarized samples. So I'm not sure it's such an important question. Moreover, nothing funny happens at this boundary. This is the only thing that happens. It's not like a phase transition. It's the only thing that happens. They go from the point where we can guarantee everything separable to a place where we can't. And, you know, as far as the operation of the computer is concerned, nothing funny happens there. So that suggests this isn't really a very important boundary. So let me tell you what the other question is you can ask. And this was thought up pretty much immediately after it was realized all the states are classical. So you have a classical model for the state at all times, which means you have one of these quasi-distributions. It's positive. The question is, can you model the dynamics from one quasi-distribution to the next using a classical transition probability? And so that is, can one make a classical model for the dynamics? Well, I guess I think this is the first question that Rüdiger and I thought of when he was had his sabbatical at UNM several years ago. And our immediate response was, sure, we can make up a model. It's just a matter of doing it. And we never succeeded. So let me just summarize then what one might want to do and tell you what we know. So over here on the left is my system at some initial time in one of these pseudo-pure states. It has a positive W. It's separable. Here it is after some unitary, some entangling unitary. Product unitaries are easy to handle. And again, it's a pseudo-pure state. It has a positive W. The question is, can we connect these two W's by some classical transition probabilities that depend only on the gate, not on the state? So under those circumstances, you'd be able to go from this initial W to the final W via some transition probability. And what the model would be saying would be you just flip coins through every entangling gate to get onto the next entangling gate. Well, we've neither proved or not proved that you can do this, but the easiest thing that you might think about doing doesn't work. That is to say, you can use the canonical W's, the ones that I talked about before, that come from this Q operator, and then you can just derive, since everything's linear, you can derive a transition matrix that goes from this W to this W. And that transition matrix is negative for every possible state. I mean, not always negative, but it's negative for some values of the input and output spins. And that's easy to see because this is just the W for a pure state. And if the pure state, actually for our W's, even pure product states have negative W's. So that didn't work. And we wrote a long paper. We managed to write a long paper describing how things didn't work. As well as we had hoped, and the outcome of that was that we weren't able to find a classical model that did the job we wanted. So that's left the impression, and it might even be true, that the power of NMR, quantum information processing, lies in the fact that they can do non-factorizable unitaries. Earlier this spring, an undergraduate student who wanted to do his senior thesis wanted a project, so I suggested that we work on the following question. If the dynamics is quantum, then we should be able to find some temporal Bell inequality, that this is a good student, actually. Otherwise, I wouldn't have suggested this problem because it's nearly impossible. But anyway, could you find a temporal Bell inequality? So you make some measurements now, you do an entangling unitary, and then you make some other measurements. You derive constraints on those measurements, provided that everything, so let me say what the assumptions are. You assume that the spins have realistic properties and that the measurements are non-disturbing. Non-disturbing you get for free in NMR because they're average measurements. And now you want to ask, what are the consequences of assuming everything has realistic properties? So could, if the dynamics is quantum, could you find a... could you find some constraint on the statistics that NMR violates? And after my student, Nick Minicucci, had absorbed all this, he eventually came to me and he said, okay, I have a model, and when we can figure out what's wrong with it, then we'll know what assumptions we have to make to derive such inequalities. But there wasn't anything with his model. So as far as we can tell, you can do the job, and there aren't going to be any such temporal Bell inequalities. That is, even if you include the dynamics, there isn't any violation of any kind of Bell inequality based on the assumption that the spins have real properties. And this is nearly trivial, so I'll just describe it very briefly. First of all, you want to pull back from the idea of using those continuous hidden variable spin directions. You only need 4 per spin, and so we use only 4 per spin. So all the integrals become sums. We do exactly the same thing as before. We go from an input distribution to an output distribution with a matrix. The matrix is the one we had before. It's some places negative, so it's not a proper transition probability. So what do? We just turn the input probabilities into hidden variables. And once they're turned into hidden variables, you can regard them as weighting a roulette wheel. And at every step of the computation, you just spin the roulette wheel, and that determines the probabilities for the hidden spins. And so there's a model where the spins have realistic properties, and you can account for all of the dynamics. It's not a very good model, because now we have an exponentially increasing number of hidden variables, but it does answer the question that there aren't going to be any Bell inequalities violated in these experiments. All right, so that's the conclusion there, and I only have a little bit of time, but I'm going to tell you a story about teleportation. So the idea there was, it's important to think about what is quantum in these experiments. And my rule was, if you can explain it in terms of realistic properties, then there's nothing quantum. So you get kind of halfway there with NMR. You can explain all the states in terms of realistic properties. And you can explain some aspects of the dynamics. We still don't have a classical transition probability that goes from an initial state to a final state. So now I want to look at a completely different experiment, one that everybody believes has true quantum information processing in it, and I'm going to tell you it doesn't have anything. So this is a heterodox conclusion. You might not want to believe it, and I'm sure that when I give this talk at Caltech on Friday, they are not going to believe it. But anyway, that's a separate question. So I'm going to tell you about teleportation. And this is teleportation of continuous variables. Now, because I wrote this little story for science, I always introduce this way instead of telling you about the actual system. The actual system is modes of the electromagnetic field, that is, light waves. And you teleport the coherent state of one light wave from this side of your laboratory to this side of your laboratory using an entangled intermediary. So I tell this in terms of swings, because swings are harmonic oscillators, at least, they aren't really, but we're not going to worry about that. We'll assume we have a harmonic swing. And so here's the story. We have two labs, one in Pasadena, one in Albuquerque. You live in Pasadena, and you like to go outside Alice's lab every Saturday and put your daughter on the swing and set her swinging. And one day, out of the blue, somebody rushes out. This is Alice, of course. Alice rushes out of her lab, grabs the swing, goes into her lab. And later on, this is a little hard to motivate. But later on, you get a call from one of your friends in Albuquerque, that is me, saying, some kid just started swinging out in the parking lot outside my office. You compare notes, and you find that this swing is swinging with the same amplitude and phase as this swing. Okay? So, you also notice, the one other crucial fact is, you notice that Alice calls Bob, the guy in Albuquerque, on the phone, and tells him something. You aren't yet wiretapping. So let's just describe what's going on here. Classically, we have the oscillation is described by an amplitude and a phase, or by X and P. And what happens is, as you get into this, you make more and more careful measurements. You find that no matter what amplitude and phase you choose for your daughter, the girl in Albuquerque swings exactly the same way. So there's an obvious explanation. Alice measures the amplitude and phase of the swinging in her lab and calls Bob and tells him what to do. So that's the obvious explanation. And since you think that's a good explanation, you say, but I know there's the uncertainty principle, so that if that's what they're doing, this swinging won't exactly duplicate this swinging, because when Alice makes her measurement, she'll get slightly the wrong answer, and this will be slightly off. And so you don't get me to do this, but you get one of my colleagues who knows what they're doing, and you make extremely careful measurements, and the thing does better than the uncertainty principle. And that's true. It does better. That's the whole point. It does better than the uncertainty principle. So at this point, you're desperate. You think there must be some very special information going from Alice to Bob, so you tap into the phone line. And what you find out is the data that Alice sends to Bob is completely uncorrelated with the kind of swinging that you choose. That is, it's just gibberish compared to the amplitude and phase that you use. Has no correlation with it whatsoever. So this has now taken quite a long time, and you're expecting to win the Nobel Prize for having done this. But Alice comes out and explains it. And here's the explanation. Alice and Bob got together in Winslow before they did this experiment, and they prepared a whole bunch of swings in a so-called EPR state. And then each one carries one swing of the pair back to Alice carries her member of the pair back to her lab, and Bob carries his back to his lab. And these are very special swings. They're ideal swings, and they're exactly correlated and anticorrelated. That is, the sum of the x's of the two swings are equal to zero, and the difference of the p's is equal to zero. Now, that's actually an infinite energy state, and they didn't do that in the lab. But they did, you know, the best they could. So Alice explains this, and she says, what I do when I take your daughter into the lab is I measure x plus xa, that is the x of your swing, plus the x of my member of the pair, I'm getting some result. And I measure p minus pa, getting some result. And now it's just the most trivial algebra you can do. She then sends these two results to Bob. Bob's swing, it turns out, his xb is minus xa, which is x minus x0. Nobody can follow equations, even ones this trivial. But they're literally completely trivial. And so Bob then applies forces to his swing to remove these random offsets, because that's the information he got from Alice. And then his swing is swinging exactly like you set your swing swinging. And that is actually an exact description of the experiment, except that it's idealized to ideal correlation instead of the approximate correlation that they have in the experiment. And the way they are able to tell that they have done something is that they compare let me just show the experiment first. You can tell me whether you like this better than the swings. They produce some squeeze states in an optical parametric amplifier. This is a so-called two-mode squeeze state. Sorry, this is separately squeezed states of two modes. They combine them in a beam splitter to make the correlated state. So one of those goes off to Alice's lab, the other goes off to Bob's lab. Victor comes in with a coherent state, which is combined in a beam splitter. And this is utterly standard optics to make two so-called balanced homodyne measurements and get out those two pieces of information. Alice then sends that information over to Bob. Bob then basically produces a field that encodes that information, combines it with this in a beam splitter. The beam splitter is very special. It's highly asymmetric, and out pops the state you hope for. And the way they test that is they compare whether this state is the same as this state by calculating the so-called fidelity, They didn't actually do this, but anyway, they effectively did this. They ask for the average value. Did I write down what the fidelity is here? No, I didn't. Anyway, it's the probability that the output state is the input state. And if you do the uncertainty principle analysis that I suggested, that fidelity is less than or equal to a half, and they observe a fidelity of 0.58 in their experiment. And that's how they conclude they did something quantum mechanical. So that was a very important experiment because in some ways it was the most sophisticated of the teleportation experiments. It was the only one done with continuous variables. But now I want to come back to my rule. I just explained that experiment to you, and actually if you'd followed the equations, you could have derived everything yourself. So I explained it to you in some realistic language, and it worked. Therefore, there's nothing quantum mechanical about it. Now, you'll notice that last week in Nielsen's talk, when he talked about teleportation, he talked about teleportation of spin states. And he started to explain it to you, and then he said, oh, this is too hard to explain, and didn't do it. And the reason is you can't explain it. Except, I mean, you can work out the consequences, but you can't, if you know quantum mechanics, but you can't explain it in realistic language. So my conclusion is that when teleporting coherent states, there is a hidden variable model for squeeze state teleportation. I just gave you that hidden variable model, and mathematically it is the fact that everything in the experiment has a so-called positive Wigner function. So you can regard the experiment as being done with classical fields that are fluctuating in the way described by the Wigner function. In terms of the swings, this means that there's a probability distribution for X and P of everything, all three parties, and it's positive, and that's a hidden variable model for the whole experiment. The protocol does use correlations in this entangled two-mode squeeze state, the EPR state, but it doesn't use those correlations in a way that require a quantum explanation. So you can argue what they've done in their experiment, whether it's quantum mechanical or not. I would say what they need to do is they need to teleport something that doesn't have a positive Wigner function. And Krzysztof Witkiewicz and I have a little model for how well this hidden variable model could do if you teleported something that didn't have a positive Wigner function in terms of fidelity. And then you'd have a clear-cut example of a quantum teleportation in continuous variables. So what's the lesson here? The lesson here is this is a very tricky business, and it's a tricky business that we need to think awfully hard about before we make claims that something truly quantum mechanical has been done. And the reason to do that is to actually understand what's truly quantum mechanical about quantum information processing. That is, I hope someday to be able to go over to El Patio and order my green chili chicken enchiladas and understand what's quantum mechanical about quantum information processing and quantum computation. Thank you.